The poor little hobbit sat down in the hall and put his head in his hands and wondered what had happened and what was going to happen and whether they would all stay to supper. Then the bell rang again, louder than ever, and he had to run to the door. It was not four, after all. It was five. Another dwarf had come along while he was wandering in the hall. He had hardly turned the knob before they were all inside, bowing and saying, "At your service," one after another. Dori, Nori, Ori, Oin, and Gloin were their names, and very soon two purple hoods, a grey hood, a brown hood, and a white hood were hanging on the pegs, and off they marched with their broad hands stuck in their gold and silver belts to join the others. Already it had almost become a throng. Some called for ale, and some for porter, and one for coffee, and all of them for cakes, so the hobbit was kept very busy for a while. A big jug of coffee had just been set in the hearth. The seed cakes were gone, and the dwarves were starting on a round of buttered scones when there came a loud knock. Not a ring, but a hard rat-tat on the hobbit's beautiful green door. Somebody was banging with a stick. Bilbo rushed along the passage, very angry, and altogether bewildered and bewothered. This was the most awkward Wednesday he ever remembered. He pulled open the door with a jerk, and they all fell in, one on top of the other. More dwarves, four more, and there was Gandalf behind, leaning on his staff and laughing. He had made quite a dent on the beautiful door. He had also, by the way, knocked out the secret mark that he had put there the morning before.
"Carefully, carefully," he said. "It is not like you, Bilbo, to keep friends waiting on the mat and then open the door like a popgun. Let me introduce Bifur, Bofur, Bomber, and especially Thorin." "At your service," said Bifur, Bofur, and Bomber, standing in a row. Then they hung up two yellow hoods and a pale green one, and also a sky-blue one with a long silver tassel. This last belonged to Thorin, an enormously important dwarf, in fact no other than the great Thorin Oakenshield himself, who was not at all pleased at falling flat on Bilbo's mat with Bifur, Bofur, and Bomber on top of him. For one thing, Bomber was immensely fat and heavy. Thorin, indeed, was very haughty, and said nothing about service, but poor Mr. Baggins said he was sorry so many times that at last he grunted,
"Pray don't mention it,"
and stopped frowning.
"Now we are all here," said Gandalf, looking at the row of 13 hoods, the best detachable party hoods, and his own hat hanging on the pegs.
"Quite a merry gathering. I hope there's something left for the late-comers to eat and drink. What's that? Tea? No, thank you. A little red wine, I think, for me." "And for me," said Thorin.
"And raspberry jam and apple tart," said Bifur.
"And mince pies and cheese," said Bofur.
"And pork pie and salad," said Bomber.
"And more cakes, and ale, and coffee, if you don't mind," called the other dwarves through the door.
"Put on a few eggs, there's a good fellow," Gandalf called after him, as the hobbit stumped off to the pantries.
"And just bring out the cold chicken and pickles."
"Seems to know as much about the inside of my larders as I do myself," thought Mr. Baggins, who was feeling positively flummoxed, and was beginning to wonder whether a most wretched adventure had not come right into his house. By the time he had got all the bottles and dishes and knives and forks and glasses and plates and spoons and things piled up on big trays, he was getting very hot and red in the face and annoyed.
"Confiscate and bother these dwarves," he said aloud. "Why don't they come and lend a hand?"
Lo and behold! There stood Balin and Dwalin at the door of the kitchen, and Feely and Keely behind them, and before he could say knife, they had whisked the trays and a couple of small tables into the parlour and set out everything afresh. Gandalf sat at the head of the party with the 13 dwarves all round, and Bilbo sat on a stool at the fireside, nibbling at a biscuit. His appetite was quite taken away, and trying to look as if this was all perfectly ordinary and not in the least an adventure. The dwarves ate and ate and talked and talked, and time got on. At last they pushed their chairs back, and Bilbo made a move to collect the plates and glasses. "I suppose you will all stay to supper," he said in his politest, unpressing tones.
"Of course," said Thorin. "And after, we shan't get through the business too late, and we must have some music first. Now to clear up."
Thereupon the 12 dwarves, not Thorin, he was too important, and stayed talking to Gandalf, jumped to their feet and made tall piles of all the things. Off they went, not waiting for trays, balancing columns of plates, each with a bottle on the top, with one hand, while the hobbit ran after them almost squeaking with fright.
"Please be careful, and please don't trouble. I can manage."
But the dwarves only started to sing.
"Chip the glasses and crack the plates, blunt the knives and bend the forks. That's what Bilbo Baggins hates. Smash the bottles and burn the corks. Cut the cloth and tread on the fat. Pour the milk on the pantry floor. Leave the bones on the bedroom mat. Splash the wine on every door. Dump the crocks in a boiling bowl, pound them up with a thumping pole, and when you're finished, if any are whole, send them down the hall to roll. That's what Bilbo Baggins hates, so carefully, carefully with the plates."
And of course they did none of these dreadful things, and everything was cleaned up and put away safe as quick as lightning, while the hobbit was turning round and round in the middle of the kitchen, trying to see what they were doing. Then they went back, and found Thorin with his feet on the fender smoking a pipe. He was blowing the most enormous smoke rings, and wherever he told one to go, it went, up the chimney, or behind the clock on the mantelpiece, or under the table, or round and round the ceiling. But wherever it went, it was not quick enough to escape Gandalf. Pop! He sent a smaller smoke ring from his short clay pipe straight through each one of Thorin's. Then Gandalf's smoke ring would go green and come back to hover over the wizard's head. He had quite a cloud of them about him already, and in the dim light it made him look strange and sorcerous. Bilbo stood still and watched. He loved smoke rings. And then he blushed to think how proud he had been yesterday morning of the smoke rings he had sent up the wind over the hill.
"Now for some music," said Thorin. "Bring out the instruments."
Keely and Feely rushed for their bags and brought back little fiddles. Dori, Nori, and Ori brought out flutes from somewhere inside their coats. Bomber produced a drum from the hall. Bifer and Bofa went out too, and came back with clarinets that they had left among the walking sticks. Dwalin and Balin said,
"Excuse me, I left mine in the porch." "Dras, bring mine in with you," said Thorin.
They came back with vials as big as themselves, and with Thorin's harp wrapped up in a green cloth. It was a beautiful golden harp, and when Thorin struck it, the music began all at once, so sudden and sweet that Bilbo forgot everything else, and was swept away into dark lands under strange moons, far over the water and very far from his hobbit hole under the hill. The dark came into the room from the little window that opened in the side of the hill. The firelight flickered. It was April, and still they played on while the shadow of Gandalf's beard wagged against the wall. The dark filled all the room, and the fire died down, and the shadows were lost, and still they played on. And suddenly first one and then another began to sing as they played, deep-throated singing of the dwarves in the deep places of their ancient homes, and this is like a fragment of their song.
Far over the misty mountains cold, to dungeons deep and caverns old, we must away ere break of day to seek the pale enchanted gold. The dwarves of yore made mighty spells, while hammers fell like ringing bells, in places deep where dark things sleep, in hollow halls beneath the fells. For ancient king and elvish lord, their many a gleaming golden hoard, they shaped and wrought, and light they caught, to hide in gems on hilt of sword. On silver necklaces they strung the flowering stars, on crowns they hung the dragon far, in twisted wire they meshed the light of moon and sun. Far over the misty mountains cold, to dungeons deep and caverns old, we must away ere break of day to claim our long-forgotten gold. Goblets they carved there for themselves, and harps of gold where no man delves, there lay they long, and many a song was sung unheard by men or elves. The pines were roaring on the height, the winds were moaning in the night, the fire was red, it flaming spread, the trees like torches blazed with light. The bells were ringing in the dale, and men looked up with faces pale. The dragon's ire more fierce than fire laid low their towers and houses frail. The mountain smoked beneath the moon, the dwarves they heard the tramp of doom. They fled their hall to dying fall beneath his feet, beneath the moon. Far over the misty mountains grim, to dungeons deep and caverns dim, we must away ere break of day to win our harps and gold from him.
As they sang, the hobbit felt the love of beautiful things made by hands and by cunning and by magic moving through him, a fierce and jealous love, the desire of the hearts of dwarves. Then something tookish woke up inside him, and he wished to go and see the great mountains, and hear the pine trees and the waterfalls, and explore the caves, and wear a sword instead of a walking stick. He looked out of the window. The stars were out in a dark sky above the trees. He thought of the jewels of the dwarves shining in dark caverns. Suddenly, in the wood beyond the water, a flame leapt up, probably somebody lighting a wood fire, and he thought of plundering dragons settling on his quiet hill and kindling it all to flames. He shuddered, and very quickly he was plain Mr. Baggins of Bag End, Underhill, again. He got up trembling. He had less than half a mind to fetch the lamp, and more than half a mind to pretend to, and go and hide behind the beer barrels in the cellar, and not come out again until all the dwarves had gone away. Suddenly he found that the music and the singing had stopped, and they were all looking at him with eyes shining in the dark.
"Where are you going?" said Thorin, in a tone that seemed to show that he guessed both halves of the hobbit's mind.
"What about a little light?" said Bilbo apologetically.
"We like the dark," said the dwarves. "Dark for dark business. There are many hours before dawn."
"Of course,"
said Bilbo, and sat down in a hurry. He missed the stool and sat in the fender, knocking over the poker and shovel with a crash.
"Hush,"
said Gandalf.
"Let Thorin speak."
And this is how Thorin began.
"Gandalf, dwarves, and Mr. Baggins, we are met together in the house of our friend and fellow conspirator, this most excellent and audacious hobbit. May the hair on his toes never fall out. All praise to his wine and ale."
He paused for breath and for a polite remark from the hobbit, but the compliments were quite lost on poor Bilbo Baggins, who was wagging his mouth in protest at being called audacious, and worst of all, fellow conspirator. Though no noise came out, he was so flummoxed. So Thorin went on.
"We are met to discuss our plans, our ways, means, policies, and devices. We shall soon, before the break of day, start on our long journey, a journey from which some of us, or perhaps all of us, except our friend and counselor, the ingenious wizard Gandalf, may never return. It is a solemn moment. Our object is, I take it, well known to us all. To the estimable Mr. Baggins, and perhaps to one or two of the younger dwarves, I think I should be right in naming Keeley and Feeler, for instance, the exact situation at the moment may require a little brief explanation."
This was Thorin's style. He was an important dwarf. If he had been allowed, he would probably have gone on like this until he was out of breath, without telling anyone there anything that was not known already. But he was rudely interrupted. Poor Bilbo couldn't bear it any longer. At "may never return," he began to feel a shriek coming up inside, and very soon it burst out like the whistle of an engine coming out of a tunnel. All the dwarves sprang up, knocking over the table. Gandalf struck a blue light on the end of his magic staff, and in its firework glare the poor little hobbit could be seen kneeling on the hearthrug, shaking like a jelly that was melting. Then he fell flat on the floor and kept on calling out,
"Struck by lightning! Struck by lightning!"
over and over again, and that was all they could get out of him for a long time. So they took him and laid him out of the way on the drawing-room sofa with a drink at his elbow, and they went back to their dark business.
"Excitable little fellow," said Gandalf, as they sat down again. "Gets funny queer fits, but he's one of the best, one of the best, as fierce as a dragon in a pinch."
If you have ever seen a dragon in a pinch, you will realize that this was only poetical exaggeration applied to any hobbit, even to old Took's great-granduncle Bullroarer, who was so huge, for a hobbit, that he could ride a horse. He charged the ranks of the goblins of Mount Graham in the Battle of the Greenfields, and knocked their king Golfimbal's head clean off with a wooden club. It sailed 100 yards through the air and went down a rabbit hole, and in this way the battle was won, and the game of golf invented at the same moment. In the meanwhile, however, Bullroarer's gentler descendant was reviving in the drawing-room. After a while, at a drink, he crept nervously to the door of the parlour. This is what he heard. Gloin speaking.
"Humph!"
or some snort, more or less like that.
"Will he do? Do you think? It is all very well for Gandalf to talk about this hobbit being fierce, but one shriek like that in a moment of excitement would be enough to wake the dragon and all his relatives and kill a lot of us. I think it sounded more like fright than excitement. In fact, if it had not been for the sign on the door, I should have been sure we'd come to the wrong house. As soon as I clapped eyes on the little fellow bobbing and puffing on the mat, I had my doubts. he looks more like a grocer than a burglar.
Then Mr. Baggins turned the handle and went in. The Took side had won. He suddenly felt he would go without bed and breakfast to be thought fierce. As for little fellow bobbing on the mat, it almost made him really fierce. Many a time afterwards the Baggins part regretted what he did now, and he said to himself, "Bilbo, you were a fool. You walked right in and put your foot in it."
"Pardon me," he said, "if I've overheard words that you are saying. I don't pretend to understand what you're talking about, or your reference to burglars, but I think I'm right in believing," this is what he called being on his dignity, "that you think I'm no good. I will show you. I have no signs on my door. It was painted a week ago, and I'm quite sure you've come to the wrong house. As soon as I saw your funny faces on the doorstep, I had my doubts. But treat it as the right house. Tell me what you want done, and I'll try it. If I have to walk from here to the east of east and fight the wild wereworms in the last desert. I had a great-great-great-granduncle once, Bull Roarer Took, and—"
"Yes, yes, but that was long ago," said Gloin. "I was talking about you, and I assure you there is a mark on this door, the usual one in the trade, or used to be. Burglar wants a good job, plenty of excitement and reasonable reward. That's how it's usually read. You can say expert treasure hunter instead of burglar, if you like. Some of them do. It's all the same to us. Gandalf told us that there was a man of the sort in these parts looking for a job at once, and that he had arranged for a meeting here this Wednesday tea-time.